Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is July the 24th. This is a Summer Bina class, and I am a substitute. I am subbing for Rabbi Feinlich, who gave his series about the Tower of Bavel, Migdal Bavel. And since he left town, I am now going to give a class on Migdal Bavel. Now, be honest with me. When is the last time anybody in this room listened to the class that we had on February, I think, 2nd, 2007, on Migdal Bavel? Okay. So
probably all of us.
Oh, I didn't know. 2007? Okay. So that was way back when we were still doing our creation series on Sunday night. So tonight we're going to this class will be similar to that one. We'll build on that one, but we're also going to add some things that were not said in that particular class. So on page 48, beginning with chapter 11, we have our nine psukim, nine verses of Migdal Bavel. Rabbi Feinlich, I'm sure, has gone through them in depth and talked about languages as his class is about. Now, we know that the storyline is that these people built this tower. And we also know that it was a form of rebellion against Hashem. It's not clear what they were doing, how they were rebelling. It's very, very obscure. Only nine psukim, very little here. It's hard to, in any way, get that much from the psukim. There's a lot more said in Tarshish Baal Peh, in the Oral Torah, but still, it's not much here. Now, there are, though, some very interesting points, very important points that we should bring out. Oh, look at this. There's some very interesting points that we should bring out that will give us some clues into some of what is happening over here. I'm sure Rav Feinlich did this, but let's read through the psukim. Let's go through them from 1 to 9. Let's just go through it quickly, so at least we have a clear picture of what's happening. The whole world was one language and one of one purpose. It says in the English, one purpose. It was when they traveled from the east. They found a valley, Be'eretz Shinar, in the land of Shinar, and they dwelled there. We know this place is Bavel, as is going to, the Torah itself is going to tell us later. And that's where they dwelt. That's where they decided to stay. Vayomru ish el reyehu, each man said to his friend, Havanil bena levinim, let us make bricks. Yeah. Vinisrafal esrefa, and burn them in fire. That's how you make bricks. So you put all the ingredients together and you burn them, you dry them out. Vatim laem al levinim la oven, and the bricks acted for them as stones. Vahachemar hayalahem la chomer. And the bitumen serve them as mortar. Last time we learned this, we also didn't know what bitumen was. Okay, whatever it is. So the as Rashi explains, there are no stones in Bavel, and therefore they needed to improvise. They had to find a way of getting themselves some building material. So they made bricks, and they have mortar, and they're going to build with these things. Vayomer, they said, Hava nivne lanu ir, let us build us a city. Umigdol, and a tower, v'roshova shamayim, and its top will be in the heavens. V'nasa lanu shem, and let us make for ourselves a name. Pen nafutz al p'nechol ha'aretz, lest we be scattered upon the face of the entire earth. Vayered Hashem, Hashem came down, liros es ha'ir ves ha'migdol, to see the city and the tower, asher banu v'nei ha'adam, that the children of man had built. Vayomer Hashem, Hashem said, Hein am echad v'safa achas v'chulam. They are, behold, they are one nation and one language for all of them. V'zeh hachilam la'asos. And this they have begun to do. And now it will not be withheld from them all that they plan to do. They'll do anything they want. There's nothing that can stop them.
Let us go down and confuse their languages, confuse their languages.
That each man will not understand, will not hear the language of his friend.
Hashem scattered them from there on the face of the entire land.
They stopped building the city.
Therefore, its name was called Bavel.
Kisham Balal Hashem Sfas Kol Haaretz, because there Hashem confused the languages of all the land.
Umisham Hafitzam Hashem, and from there Hashem scattered them up Kol Haaretz, on the face of the entire land.
These people who tried to build this Migdol, this tower and this city, were descendants, of course, of Shem, Ham, and Yefes. They were descendants of Noach's children, who had lived through the Mabul, through the flood, and here they were rebelling against Hashem. It's not clear, again, it's not clear from reading the Pesukim exactly how they were rebelling from Hashem. What is it that they wanted from the city? At least what is explicitly stated in the Pesukim. What did they want from the city?
They wanted
a city that would, with its head in a tower with its head in the sky. But what did they want from it? What were they seeking to do?
To make a name for themselves.
To make a name for themselves, A. That was the positive. And the negative was?
Not
be dispersed. They wanted to make for themselves a name and not be dispersed. In the end, what does Hashem do to them?
He disperses
them. Right. So they didn't want to be dispersed. He disperses them. Hashem was not pleased with this building they were making. So apparently, even though we don't know exactly what the building was, and we don't know exactly what the city was, but we do know that it was not in keeping with what Hashem wanted. And the Gemara, in fact, tells us, the Talmud says, that they lost their portion in the world to come. Which means that they were pretty bad. We, again, not clear exactly what they did that was so bad, but it was bad. So we don't need, for the purposes of tonight's discussion, we don't need to delve into exactly what it is that they were building and how that was somehow a rebellion against Hashem. We don't really need to know that for tonight's discussion, but we don't need to question that either. It is clear and obvious that this was a rebellion against Hashem, because otherwise, why would Hashem have stopped it? Why would Hashem have scattered them? If it wasn't for the fact that they were doing evil, there was no need for Hashem to confuse their languages and scatter them. Clearly Hashem does not like what they're doing. The Gemara says they lost a chelik in Olam Haba, they lost a portion of the world to come. It must be pretty bad. Okay, fine. Now, they spoke one language, which I understand is what Rabbi Freundlich spoke about in depth, about languages. And Hashem made it that they could only, that they did not speak the same language. So, as Rashi explains, by making them not speak the same language, that's why they scattered. Because they couldn't communicate with each other. And that's why they couldn't stay together anymore. People are able to remain together so long as they can communicate. When people can't communicate with each other, then they can't stay together with each other. There's nothing that can hold them together because they can't interact without communication. So Hashem confused their languages, which then caused them to scatter. Now, would we say, objectively,
that being together and not being scattered, being together, objectively speaking, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Togetherness.
That's good. Look
at this.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, that's what you should. Are you saying it's a good thing that people get together?
Is it a good thing that they're able to be together, or that they have to be scattered?
The people here in this story. So I would think, objectively speaking, that togetherness, unity,
is a good thing. Right? We know that that is something that we strive for and is very elusive. As simple as the words sound, let's all get together, why can't we just all get along with each other? Everybody likes to say that. Anytime you have communal meetings, if people get up and say, we should just all get along with each other. It's real easy to say, very hard to do. Because we don't all think alike, we don't all have the same ideas, we don't all have the same goals, and therefore people don't stay together. People have a lot of trouble with shalom. But the Dor HaFlaga, this generation, had shalom. In fact, the Gemara itself draws our attention to that they had shalom, that they had unity, because the Gemara says that although they were bad, they rebelled against Hashem, although that's true, and although it's true that the Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood, also rebelled against Hashem, but the generation of the flood were killed. And here they weren't killed, they were just scattered. So the Gemara tells us, why were they only scattered? Because they had shalom. Since they had peace, they had unity, that was the reason why Hashem did not kill them, as opposed to the Mabul, as opposed to the flood. Because Hashem ultimately loves shalom. He wants shalom. He wants there to be peace. Shalom is extremely important as far as Hashem is concerned. We mentioned last time we learned this, which was a mere 3.5 years ago, that shalom is so significant to Hashem that the word shalom doesn't only mean hello, goodbye, and peace. It also means it's one of His names, one of Hashem's names. That is how significant the word, the concept of shalom is to Hashem. Hashem is, of course, the essence of shalom, because Hashem is echad. Hashem is one. Hashem, there is only one Hashem, and Hashem Himself has no parts. Hashem is, as complex as we think about Hashem, Hashem ultimately is a very simple being, because Hashem has no parts. There is no, as we have different parts of our bodies. We have different parts of our bodies, parts of our bodies that do different things, parts of our bodies that are tougher and not as tough, more sensitive. We have parts of our bodies that are able to move in certain ways and other parts that can't move in certain ways. We have internal parts of the bodies, we have external parts of the bodies. Our bodies are very, very are very varied. There's a lot of different pieces to us. That's our physical bodies. Our emotional selves, we have a lot of different emotions, and the emotions often conflict with each other, and they often one rises to the top, another one rises to the top. We are beings that have a lot of conflict emotionally, all of us. And then we have a spiritual side as well that has a whole other dimension to it. We're very, very complex. We have a lot of different aspects and parts to us. Hashem has no parts. Hashem has no aspects. Hashem has no pieces. Hashem has no emotions. Hashem has no body. Hashem doesn't have a physical side or a spiritual side. And Hashem just is. He is the quintessential echad, one. So for Him, unity is what He is. He is shalom. He is a uniform shalom, peace, echad. And therefore, if the world, or the Jews, if we are to mimic Hashem, if we are trying to connect ourselves to Hashem, to perfect ourselves, how do we perfect ourselves? We perfect ourselves by being as godlike as possible. Obviously, a human being can never be truly godlike, but to be as godlike as possible. That's the purpose of this world. That all of us, individually, and all of us collectively, make ourselves as godlike as possible. And shalom is godlike. Because Hashem is shalom. Hashem is echad. If we have unity, if we are at peace, we are very much like God. And that's one of the major goals of this world. Yeah?
In the time of Noah, when Hashem looked down and saw the world the way it was and deciding he was going to send his life. Okay, you said he has no feeling, no emotion. So what made him decide to do that?
He has, yeah, he has rules for us. He has rules for this world because he wants this world to reach perfection. So if the world is not headed in the direction of perfection, he needs to intervene and set it up differently. That's where you get into reward and punishment. But it's not a question of emotion. Whenever the Torah uses emotions with Hashem, it's no different than when the Torah uses parts of bodies for Hashem. When it says Hashem's hand, he doesn't have a hand. But it's using a term that we can understand. The same thing goes for Hashem's emotions. He doesn't have anger or fear or love or hate. Hashem doesn't have any of that. But the Torah expresses it in a way that we can understand what it is that Hashem is doing. Hashem would act as if he were angry. Hashem acts as if he loves. That's the way to understand that. But it's not true emotion. He's not a human being. So, Achdus, unity, Shalom, peace, these are very important things that Hashem really wants for the entire world. And the Dor HaFlaga, this generation, had those things. They were Dvarim Achadim. They were one purpose, one language, one people. Very wonderful trait to have. They misused it, as Dina said. They misused it. They used it as a way to rebel against Hashem instead of as a way to bring themselves close to Hashem. And as a result, Hashem scatters them. So it's an ironic thing. They had the one quality that is so superlative. They had peace. They had unity. But because they misused it, Hashem scattered them and took away their unity. And that's what we have today. The world we live in today is a different world than they had then. They lived in a world, as I mentioned last time, 3.5 years ago. I listened to the class today, so that's in order to remind myself of what we said 3.5 years ago. They lived in a world where unity, where shalom, where achdus, these things came relatively easily. They spoke the same language. They felt a kinship with each other. It didn't matter how they looked. It didn't matter whether they were tall or short, or what color they were, or what place on the earth they came from. There was a sense of unity because they shared the common language. There was a kinship that they had. And as a result of that, the unity came more naturally. It came more easily to them. But when they acted the way they acted with their unity, Hashem scattered them. And now the world we live in is a world where unity is elusive, where shalom, where peace is elusive. And that's primarily because we don't understand each other. A different language doesn't only mean that when you say the word shulchan in Hebrew, I don't know that it means table, because I don't know Hebrew. It doesn't just mean that. Different languages means different cultures. It means a different worldview. It means different experiences. It means when you meet someone from a different country who speaks a different language, who had a completely different upbringing, then the barrier between me and that person is very, very strong. We don't have a point of connection. We don't have a way of saying, oh yeah, right. We don't have the Jewish geography to connect us. Why do Jews do that? It's a connector when you have Jewish geography. When you meet another Jew and you're able to find some connection, so now, hey, we're buddies. We have a way of connecting. We have a point of connection between us. You meet someone who you have no point of connection at all, then there's no conversation starter. There's not even a way of getting the ball rolling. At least, if we're both Jewish, we can at least talk Judaism. That we have in common. But if you're not even the same religion, I mean, you don't even have that. I mean, where do you even begin the conversation? It's almost impossible. And especially, you don't have the same language. So there's just no way. And it's a lot easier to be in conflict
with a person with whom you don't share anything than it is to be in unity. And the world we live in today is the antithesis of what they had. We live in a world where the natural state is conflict. Unity, achdus, you have to work on to get to. But the natural state of the world is conflict. Let everybody go, there will be wars. There will be conflict. Because the natural state is, we don't know how to get along with each other. We don't know each other. We have nothing to do with each other. I have no reason to interact with you. You have no reason to interact with me. That's the natural state of the world today. That is a result of this episode. Hashem took away their unity. Last time, we discussed this irony that Hashem took away their unity. That it's a funny thing, that it's something which Hashem prizes so much, yet that's what He took away from them. Okay, that was a discussion we had last time. I want to make some other observations tonight. When they came to what the Torah calls Shinar, later it was called Babel, same place. When they came to this place, Babylonia, there were no bricks. Excuse me, there were no stones. They couldn't build. They wanted to build, but they couldn't build. Now, why did they want to build? They wanted to make this city and this tower. And it was in order that they shouldn't scatter. They should remain together. That's what they wanted. But as we know, it was not for good purposes. But they wanted to build. They couldn't build without these things. Is it easier to build if you naturally have the building materials there, like stone, or if you don't? Well, that's obvious. Right? Obviously, it's a lot easier if you have the stones there. If you don't have the stones there and you have to somehow make stones by making bricks, that's a lot more difficult. So the building that they built required a lot of effort. So it is noteworthy that they settled in a place that didn't have stones. Had they settled in a place that had stones, they wouldn't have had to make bricks. It's because they settled in a place that didn't have stones, they now needed to make bricks. Why they settled here? Rashi says they couldn't find a place that was large enough to hold them, except for this place, except for Shinar or Babel, Babylonia. That it was large enough to hold all these people. It seems to me, not in contradiction to what Rashi is saying, but I think we can add something here as well. It seems to me that their design, their interest in remaining together, meant that they wanted to be in a place where building wasn't just taking the material that was there and building with it. They wanted to be in a place where they needed to manufacture the building materials. They had to make bricks. Why would that be so? Why would it be, picture yourself amongst these people. We don't know much about them. We just know that they're rebelling against Hashem. But we do know, the one thing the Torah tells us is, they didn't want to be scattered. They wanted to remain together. They wanted to preserve their unity. Why would they then choose a place that didn't have natural building materials and opt instead for a place that did not have it? And now they have to manufacture the building materials.
I would think that they could say, see, you know, we did this from nothing. We look how great we are. We had nothing, and look, we took this branch and
we took this. Okay. So there's no question when you make something from scratch, there is a sense of accomplishment. And you couldn't do it, and you look at it and say, look what we did. And we all feel this way. Anytime we do anything that we feel accomplished in, it's something that makes us feel good. That makes us feel good. I'll just tell you a little aside, is that I have, for a little bit of time now, I've wanted to make an omelet. I never made an omelet in my life, but I wanted to make an omelet. So, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, I went online and I watched 3 short clips of how to make an omelet. It's amazing what you could do today. And then I made an omelet. And I made an omelet and I showed my daughters. I said, look, look. I was so excited. They didn't know what I was so excited about. I said, look, I made an omelet. Look at that. Good, I did it. Right? Now, if I would have gone out and bought an omelet, I wouldn't have felt that way, right? And who you wouldn't feel that way because you bought an omelet. You may have gotten what you wanted in your stomach, but you wouldn't have felt good about making it, right? So there's a sense of accomplishment when you do something from scratch. When you do something from scratch that you could not have done alone, that you need everybody else to do it with you, that sense of accomplishment is much more profound than what you did yourself. Because it not only gives you the sense of accomplishment, look what I did, but it's look what we did. This wouldn't be here if it wasn't for us. We were all needed to build this thing. This ear, this city, and this Migdal, and this tower could only be built when these people started with dirt and manufactured bricks, manufactured mortar, put them together and built this structure. And when the structure would be finished, which they never finished it, Hashem stopped it in the middle. Had they finished the structure, whatever they were trying to build, they would stand back at this structure and say, look at what we accomplished. This is us. That in and of itself binds people together. When you look at what we accomplished, it binds people together. And that's what they wanted more than anything else, was they shouldn't scatter. We want to remain together. Had the stones been there, they still would have accomplished something. But it wouldn't have been as profound. It would not have been the same sense of accomplishment. We made this out of nothing. There was nothing here. And now look what's here. That's the sense of accomplishment that they wanted, but not from one person. From the entire group together.
Isn't that also part of rebellion? Because take a place that had nothing like the Midbar. And when the Midbar has just tried for all I need. So if you place it, they don't have the stone, they don't have the building materials. It's so interesting. We don't need to have Hashem, we have the power within ourselves.
Okay, so it's possible that that was the rebellion. Again, the Torah does not tell us how they were rebelling. We know they were. But it doesn't tell us how. It's possible that the way they were rebelling is they were saying, we don't need you, God.
Right.
We can do it all by ourselves.
There's only so many fetch. You know, anytime you go into a place and you can't find this or wood to make a fire, you're camping at, you catch about, oh, this is so hard, why do you plan a trip, why do you go camping? But here, I think it's part of the rebellion because barren, nothing there to help them build it. And it's like, we don't need you, God. We can do it all on our own.
Very likely. Very likely. That's a nice shot. It's a nice explanation. In the end, Hashem scatters them. In the end, their unity is misplaced, and Hashem scatters them, and they stop building this tower. Now, I want to move to something which will appear to be a digression, but we will show how it will tie in very significantly. We Jews, we know that unity, achdus, shalom, is something which we need to have. We crave it, we talk about it all the time. It's now the 3 weeks. This is a theme which is always said during the 3 weeks because we know that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of sinas chinam, because of baseless hatred. And it's something which we know that we must strive to do. And as I said before, it's not easy. It's not easy. I think part of what undermines us is that we think of it as let's just get along with each other. We think of it as an easy thing, rather than approach it as knowing and understanding and accepting the fact that it's difficult and it needs a lot of work. It really does. And if you don't set it as a goal, as I am going to get along no matter what, I'm going to get along, then in the end we will not get along. It's got to be something which we put at the forefront of our minds. It's not going to happen by itself. It's something which we all need to constantly keep in the forefront of our minds. That's what we Jews want and need. Yeah.
So I think that a big problem is the Aryeh Yitzhara.
Of course, right?
Look what she did, and look what he did, and look what they said, and look what they didn't do. And how come they didn't do this?
You're 100% right. You're 100% right. The Yetzer Hara.
Such a good reason to, you know, feel hurt, feel abandoned.
Right.
Feel...
You're 100% right. We are all...
So we're all fighting that thing.
That's right. That's right. We're all walking around thinking that this person was out to get me, this person was doing this to me, this person didn't, why didn't... And we have all this stuff built up inside of us, and that stops us from getting along. But that's what we want, that's what we need. If we Jews would get along with each other, since we are the ones from whom the rest of the world takes their cue, the rest of the world would follow suit. We're really the ones that are the trigger for the rest of the world. But we know that it's very hard, and we don't all get along with each other. Where do Jews first not get along with each other? Where does that first happen? We know that in the world, the first two people not to get along with each other are
Cain
and Hevel, Cain and Abel. Okay, and then later on, we have other examples of people not getting along with each other. We have Yishmael, we have Esav, but as Jews, when do we first not get along with each other?
When you say as Jews, we mean after we receive the Torah?
No, even before.
Korach?
Even before Korach.
Yosef?
His brothers sell him. That's a pretty bad not getting along with each other, right? His brothers sell him. The Jews don't get along with each other over there. The brothers sell Yosef. But even that is preceded by another not getting along with each other, although it's much more subtle. That's an overt not getting along with each other. They sell their brother. That's pretty bad. But that the selling of Yosef actually has its roots in a previous not getting along with each other. No, because Esav isn't Jewish. I mean, he's technically a Jew that went off, that went away from Judaism, but I'm not counting him. I'm counting only within the people who we consider.
Yeah.
Well, Yishmael also is not Jewish. The seeds of Yosef being sold by their brothers, that is really, the root of that is really Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah, who really do get along with each other, but it's a mighty struggle. It's a mighty, mighty struggle. And we know why it's a mighty struggle, because they really had the deck stacked against them to begin with. It really was an incredible, incredible, difficult task for Rachel and Leah to get along with each other. If Rachel and Leah would not have been Rachel and Leah, the great matriarchs, it would have been World War, at that time World War One, World War, actually. It would have been a World War. There would have been no unity whatsoever in Yaakov's home. Why? Why would there have been incredible disunity? Think about it. Think about the circumstances. Rachel is the loved one. She's the one who Yaakov works for 7 years. Yaakov knows that he's working for Rachel. Rachel knows she's being worked for. Rachel is waiting 7 years for this wonderful man to marry her, and she loves him, he loves her. It's a beautiful story. At the last moment, Rachel is displaced by Leah. Now granted, Rachel does an incredible chesed. We spoke about this when we learned about Rachel and Leah, that Rachel does a chesed, she does a kindness which is unsurpassed in all of human history. This kindness that she does for her sister is beyond the scope of imagination. It is incredible what she is willing to give up for another person. But she does it. Granted, that's what happens. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, she's displaced by her sister Leah. So Leah now is married to this man. Leah knows that Yaakov wasn't interested in her to begin with. Leah knows that Yaakov was really interested in Rachel. And 1 week later, Yaakov does marry Rachel. He marries Leah. A week later, he marries Rachel. So all of a sudden, there are now two brides. There is Leah, and a week later, there is Rachel. So yes, Leah displaced Rachel, but now Rachel's in the home too. So Yaakov has two wives, Rachel and Leah. And Leah's sitting there knowing that she wasn't supposed to be here. It really wasn't supposed to happen. It's not what Yaakov wanted. It's not what Rachel wanted. I'm really coming between them. Leah knows that. And Hashem sees that Leah is the not the loved one. So Hashem gives her children and does not give Rachel children. And so Leah has child after child after child after child. She has four children. And Rachel has none. And remember that we're talking about our patriarchs and matriarchs. We're not talking about people who are infatuated with each other for purely physical reasons. We're talking about people who are intent on building a nation. That's the reason why they married. Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel and Rachel only because he saw correctly in Rachel the strengths that were necessary for Yaakov to build the Bnei Yisrael, to build the Jewish people. And that's their intent. So if Rachel is not having children and Leah is, then what's happening is that Leah is the one building the Jewish people with Yaakov and not Rachel. That will obviously create a sense of besides jealousy, a sense of unworthiness. Right, on the part of Rachel. I'm not doing my job. Because the whole purpose of Yaakov marrying me was to bring about the Jewish people, and I'm not contributing. And so, yeah, then Rachel brings her maid, Bilhah. She has two children. Leah then brings her maid, Zilpah. She has two children. Then they barter over the dudayim, over the flowers that Reuben brings from the field. And again, Leah has two more children. Two more boys. So she's got six. Rachel has none. And then Leah becomes pregnant again. And we know that there Leah does an incredible thing. She gives up the ability to have contributed yet another one of the tribes to the Jewish people because she doesn't want her sister to even have fewer than the maids. And so she dies and the boy is turned into a girl. That's Dinah. Wonderful. And then finally, Rachel has the two boys, has Yosef and then Binyamin, and she dies in childbirth with Binyamin. If these two people, Rachel and Leah, if they were normal human beings, you understand that there would be incredible antagonism between the two of them. Incredible antagonism. You understand that they wouldn't be able to live in the same city with each other. You understand that there would be constant maligning each other, constant bickering, constant lush and hara between the two. It would be going on and on and on. They would be dragging in their children into the fight. It would be like having an open warfare divorce, but not divorced. Actually in the same family, because they're still married to Yaakov. But there would be incredible fighting between the two of them. Rachel and Leah, because of who they were, because of the lofty people who they were above this, and it's only the very, very, very subtle aspects of this potential fight that happen. The very subtle ones, as we pointed out when we learned this way back when, that it's only Hashem that knows that Leah is unloved. Leah doesn't even know she's unloved. Yaakov rises above this, and Leah doesn't realize from Yaakov that she's not loved. It's Hashem saw she wasn't loved, and therefore Hashem gave her a child. And we see over and over again that Rachel and Leah are bending over backwards to try to not be at odds with each other. But the fact remains that...
Are you saying Rachel and Leah didn't know that she wasn't loved?
Yes, we learned that back then. Not for tonight.
What? So... I thought she cried all the time.
That was before she married Yaakov.
Oh, yeah?
So, but the two of them, but they even though they rose above almost all of this human, normal human emotional fighting that which would have gone on, they rose above it. But at the same time, it's there. There's the Rachel side of the family, and there's the Leah side of the family. The Leah side of the family are 10 of the tribes. The Rachel side of the family is Yosef and Binyamin. And when Yaakov favors Yosef, giving Yosef the kesonas pasim, the coat, when Yaakov gives that to Yosef, the brothers are jealous. Yosef doesn't help the matter by reporting on his brothers. And though those seeds of dissension, which are there already because you have the Rachel side and the Leah side, they find expression in the brothers having a significant difference of opinion, and it results in the sale of Yosef. And it takes 22 years for that to come full circle, and we know what happens when in Egypt, and Yosef finally reveals himself and the whole thing. But the seeds of dissension amongst the Jewish people, is the root of it, is Rachel and Leah. Yeah.
So I realized that, you know, the concept that if you do a good thing, like it's too good, like it could become bad. Like, are you too kind at the wrong?
If you're overly kind, then that's not a kindness anymore. One who is too kind is no longer kind. It becomes cruel.
It's cruel. So I was wondering, I just got a glimpse of that in even though Rachel did something incredibly and a respectful person, it turned out to be kind of cruel.
That, in this case, it would have been worse had she not done it. And remember, Rachel is remembered for this. The Torah says that she is. It's her, in her merit that we're going to be redeemed. So her act was the correct thing to do. How is it that we had this situation of Rachel and Leah? How did that happen? How did it happen that we ended up with Yaakov having two wives, and Leah is married first, and then Rachel, and how did that whole thing come about? Who is responsible for that mess?
Hashem.
Okay, Hashem is true, but who is the person responsible? Lavan. Lavan is the person responsible. Rachel and Leah's father, Lavan, who tricked Yaakov and substituted Leah for Rachel. Rachel for Leah.
It is. It doesn't sound like me.
What then?
I mean, you know, everyone says Lava was a trickster. Like, he was a very good man. But, you know, Jacob accepted it. Leah accepted it. Rachel did it, actually.
Yaakov didn't accept it.
He married both ways.
He didn't know that it was Leah. He was stuck. He was already married.
So, you know, Leah tried his tricks, but, you know, it was.
He was a treacherous person. He did it.
He was, but you know, Rachel.
In order not to shame her sister, again, the Torah says she did the right thing. Can I tell you that all the sages, everybody says that what Rachel did was 1,000% correct under the circumstances, because of the evil and treachery of Lavan, the choice was shame her sister or let her marry Yaakov. And she did an incredible chesed, allowing her to marry Yaakov. But it was not good that Lavan did that. Lavan was still evil. Lavan is ultimately the root cause of dissension amongst the Jewish people. If you want to trace our dissension, why can't we Jews get along with each other? Why is it so hard? It's hard for everybody to get along with everybody. That's because of the episode we're learning tonight, because of the Tower of Babel. But why are we Jews? Why do we have trouble with each other? The root of that is Lavan. The root is the sale of Yosef, which goes back to Rachel and Leah, which goes back to Lavan. Lavan is the root cause of dissension amongst the Jewish people. Take a look, please, in the Chumash in front of you on page 48. What is it that they didn't have stones? So what did they use instead? Didn't have stones, so they made bricks. And what is the Hebrew word for brick? Look in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Levanim. Levana.
Lavan.
Lavan.
Is that
That is a hint. That is a remez. Lavan, this is the first time in the Chumash where you have, I believe, the first time in the Chumash where you have these letters together in that way. In Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, I'll read the Hebrew. Vayomer ish el reyehu, each man said to his friend, Hava, let us nil bina livenim. Let us brick bricks. Let's make bricks. Lamed beiz nun. And again, reading further, Minister Phelps Refa will burn them. We'll make them, burn them in fire. Vatilahem halivena le'oven. We will make the levena, the lamed beiz nun, lavan, we'll make it into stone.
That does deserve to get on the board. So let's put that up. I have a thing here. So that is the hint. You know, look at all this. Oh, okay. That is the hint to. I can do this very well. What's that? Yeah. Well, tomorrow night we'll do it again. We have to do it again anyway. You probably all can't see this. Turn it a little bit. Okay. So we have the word Livena. And we have the word Lafun. Lamed Beis Nun Hey, Lamed Beis Nun. They're the same root. Lavan and Livena. How are we to understand that? Remember we said before that the bricks were a form of unity. They were a form of unity. Lavan is the source of disunity for the Jewish people. Lavan creates disunity amongst the Jewish people. More than that, Lavan means what? Just a translation of the word Lavan. It means white. The color white. Levena means brick. Lavan means white. The color white. If you talk about colors, and you talk about white, just pure white, does that suggest to you disunity or unity?
Unity.
You would think unity. Just pure white, a pure white canvas. You'd think unity. Lavan, really, his name suggests unity. That's what it would suggest. Well, that's a scientific thing. It's true. You know, I don't know how that works out. If it's the absence of color or it's the blending of colors, I'm not even sure how that, you know.
It's the blending of colors.
Is that?
Because you put all the colors together to make black.
No, I think white is the blending of colors.
White
is. Yeah, when you take a prism, you break up the light into many colors. I think white. But I don't want to move into the scientific explanation of color. But what it conjures up in your mind when you think about a pure white canvas is it's just plain. It just is. It's uniform. Lavan really should have been pure, uniform. It's achdus. It is the oneness. The levena, the brick, which requires people coming together and putting things together and building a structure the same way they did over here. But Lavan instead, he sows the seeds of disunity amongst the Jewish people. That's the name Lavan. And I want to show you one other thing, one other curiosity. Let's keep reading over here. So they build this city, and they build the building, and Hashem comes down and he doesn't like what he sees. And therefore he says, Pasuk Zion, verse 7, look carefully at the Hebrew words. Hava nerda, let us go down. Vinavla sham sifasam, let us confuse their languages. Asher lo yishmu ish sasriyehu, that no man will hear the language of his friend. What is the word for confuse?
Navla. Navla is the opposite letters of Lavan. It's Lavan backwards. Right? Navla. Now, Navla, the hey is actually a suffix. That's for we will confuse. The root is actually Nun Beis Lamed. So I'm gonna put the hey here, but I'll leave it in parentheses. Navla. So we have brick. Whoops. Brick. We have white. And we have confuse. So there, this word to confuse is the same word backwards. You take Lavan and you reverse the letters, you get confuse. When it's in this direction, it's white, which would suggest unity. Confusion is the opposite of unity. That's disunity. When I don't know what's going on, and I've got this thing and that thing going on, and I'm not sure whether I'm coming or going, I'm confused, there's disunity. That's when all my parts, all my emotional parts, my intellectual parts, my feel, I'm just totally discombobulated. That is navla, that's confusion. That is the reverse of lavan. That's navla, naval. And naval actually also means, naval can mean also disgusting. The word naval can also mean disgusting. So here it is fascinating to see that in this story, which does not seem on the surface to have anything to do with the Jewish people directly, it has to do with the whole world, but we don't see any direct reference to the Jewish people. Certainly we don't see a direct reference to Lavan and Rachel and Leah and the sale of Yosef, but really it's all hinted to over here. It's all, when you read it and you see the way the Torah presents it, it's all being foreshadowed here with unity and disunity, with simplicity and confusion, with a pure white canvas versus splotches of color all over the place. That is embedded here in the story of the Tower of Babel. That's the part we didn't talk about last time. That's the way I understand the Haggadah, that he wanted to destroy the Jewish people by sowing the seeds of disunity. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing is, most of it is that Shalom is so stressed. If you look at all of our davening, that's right. Then Shalom comes up and must get Shalom laying of us. So Shalom is a very stressful
one. Yeah. When you said Shalom is stressed, you don't mean that there's stress.
No.
It's emphasized. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're right. You're right.
Rabbi Freilich mentioned that when they were making the tower and the men were up on top and somebody fell off and died, the people just said,
the tower became.
Fell, but if a brick fell,
they went to mourning. Right.
How does that show Shalom and unity?
Well, I think it shows a common purpose. As everybody felt that this building was more important than the individual. When you take the group and you say the group is more important than the individual, the whole is more important than the individual. We all believe that to a certain extent. If there is a situation where an entire group of people will be killed, God forbid, and the only way to save them is if one person gets killed from that group, so logic would dictate that one person should be killed rather than the whole group, right? So we will put the individual second to the group when the whole group is threatened. That notion can be abused, where the group takes on such a significance where there's no individual rights, no individual value. That's what happened over here. That the notion of the group, which was represented by the building, that took over and that became the end all and be all, and the individuals became insignificant.
I kept
one ringer in class. The only other time I can think of is when we talk about bricks so much is when they were in the church.
That's right. That's right. I was going to mention that. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And it becomes emphasized because Paro takes away the straw, and now they have to go and find the straw to make the bricks. So you see that there's bricks there as well. They don't have stones. They're using bricks. Right. That's a very, very good point. Well, I mean, there, the simple meaning is Paro wants them to work hard. But obviously, yes, yes, yeah. No question about it. No question about it.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.